We shall now look forward to the presentation this evening by Malcolm Shrimpton on the economy and God.
Well, does God have anything to do with our economy? If you have been reading the newspapers recently, and there's been a series of comments taken from the Financial Post in our local paper that analyze this whole issue of the economy, what's gone wrong, and what will be needed to reverse the terrible tendencies that are going on in the world roundabout, you'll find that God isn't mentioned at all. For the most part, the people that blame the troubles in our economy, the thing that they blame mostly is a lack of regulation, a lack of oversight, not strong enough rules, not enough liquidity, or not enough control of the way money is allowed to move within our society. Occasionally, a few of the people who have talked on this topic will point out that what has really gone wrong has been that everybody just got a little bit too greedy. The most common thing that people cite is this whole matter of mortgages in the southern states, where people were encouraged by government policies to buy houses. They were, easy money was allowed and restrictions on mortgages were eased so that people could get mortgages for something like 110% of their house. This allowed you to put the money down on your house, allowed you to pay all the fees and taxes and everything that went into buying your house and put the whole business on the mortgage. And it worked wonderfully for a long time until interest rates started to go up, mortgages started to be rewritten, and people found that they could not afford to pay the mortgage. And then the other horrible thing happened that the real estate market started to slide a little bit, and all of a sudden people realized when the mortgage came to be renewed that they owed more than their house was worth, and the bank started to balk at this. Ah, you see, that's what went wrong. There wasn't enough regulation. But then, the other thing that people point out now occasionally is that, well, maybe the people who took the mortgage should have been a little more prudent. Maybe they should have thought that it's just possible that they wouldn't be able to pay that mortgage in a few days. Maybe they should have been a little more cautious. Maybe that was the problem. Maybe everybody was just not prudent enough with the way their money was handled. Ah, yes, now that's the real problem. But then a few analysts and people that really look seriously at what's going on in our society pointed out that something else had been going on. The bank managers had been given large performance-based raises. And the performance-based raise was based, believe it or not, on the stock value of the bank that they were managing. How do you raise the stock value of your bank? Well, you make a lot of money for the bank. You encourage people to buy these mortgages and things like that. You lend money, and then you do something which was really creative. You decide that your bank is not going to keep the mortgage which they have let. You're going to pile all these mortgages up that you've lent, make a big bundle of them, as they call it, and sell it to Iceland or somewhere like that. And Iceland would then collect the money for these mortgages which had been let in, let's say, Southern California. That's wonderful, isn't it? Because the bank in Southern California can now lend the money all over again. And on and on and on this went. So what happened when people got into a little trouble and when they went to their bank and said, look, if we can just rewrite this mortgage, if I can just rewrite this thing, I could keep my house. You wouldn't end up with a piece of worthless real estate on your hands. We could keep things going. Not quite as well as they were, but we could keep them going. Unfortunately, it seems the bank no longer controlled the mortgage and was completely unwilling then, or unable, I'm not sure which, to actually rewrite the mortgage. Well, there we go. There we go. if we had raised this topic 500 years ago, there would have been no question in people's minds that God was behind it. You see, in those days, if there was a crop failure, it was because we hadn't been sufficiently aware of what God wanted. We hadn't been good citizens. We hadn't been good members of God's church. And therefore, God was bringing this crop failure down on our heads as punishment for what we had done. Conversely, if there was a good harvest, well, God must be smiling on us and think we must be doing things right. The Black Death, when it occurred throughout Europe, was seen as a visitation from the divine. And groups of people walked around the highways, some of them beating themselves with whips, because they knew that they had sinned and they had brought this thing upon themselves because of their sin. And when they had punished themselves sufficiently, when they had whipped themselves enough and their punishment was complete, God would lift this terrible thing from them, this terrible disease from them. People thought that way. People thought that good things came because God smiled on us. Bad things came because God frowned on us. And it was because of what we had done. We brought this on ourselves because of the way we treated God. Now, isn't it interesting that when you look at that section that we read and from Ezekiel, from the Old Testament, you see very much this point of view. And God says directly to that city on the Mediterranean, on the coast of the Mediterranean, I'm going to destroy you because of the way you've behaved. I'm going to destroy you because of the way you've been behaving. But if you look at the middle section of that, we see all kinds of modern ideas. All kinds of modern ideas. You see the newspaper headlines that we're reading. You see the very words that we talk about on a daily basis. Riches, gold and silver. Price of gold is on the television every day. And the price of silver. They don't put platinum on there anymore, but they do put oil and gas. Price of commodities. They're quoted to you on a daily basis. By your great wisdom and by traffic, you've increased your riches. Now that's the solution to today's problems. Trade. Not just trade from here to Vancouver or from here to Nanaimo, but trade with China, trade with Japan, trade with Europe. These people, the Phoenicians, began that whole business in the Middle East. And they got very rich because they traded throughout the Middle East. And things that landed on their coast in the Middle East went inland and went south and went north up into Syria. And we can see in the archaeological record the fact that things were traded throughout the Middle East. That men got very rich because of this. It's been going on for a long time. And because people put their personal welfare ahead of their God, and because these people made themselves equivalent to God, and that's the phrase there, I don't need you, God, in so many words. I don't need you, God, anymore. I'm all right, Jack, was the phrase in the Second World War. I can look after things. I don't have to worry about this. I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing. That's what people said here only 6 months ago. We know what we're doing. And now we're getting a solution. Every country in the major developed nations in the world is engaging on a whole series of what are called stimulative deficits. The fascinating part about this is that this form of economics was developed in the 1920s, really being finally published in the 40s, became current thinking after the war, after the Second World War. The whole idea was that in good times, governments would put money in the bank, and in bad times, governments would spend that money, which they had in the bank. The interesting thing is, and we're going to come back to this point at the very end of the talk, the interesting thing is that governments have not been putting anything in the bank. Governments have been increasing their borrowing. Canada is bragging because we have been putting money in the bank recently. But what we've actually been doing is reducing our national debt, not getting rid of it. And so we're not in that good a situation. Well, with that little sort of tirade almost, let's call it that, about the way things are going in the world and the way religious thinking has changed over the years, because we have gone from a point of view when people really believed that God looked after their lives, that God was involved in people's lives on a daily basis, that God was involved in the lives of nations on a continuing basis. In the space of 200 or 300 years, really starting with the Reformation and starting with the idea that people should be allowed to think for themselves, we've gradually got rid of the thinking that God is a permanent part of our lives, for good or for bad. So let's go back and let's build up once again just what it is that the Bible says about the way we live, the way God intends us to live, and the things that God has provided for us. What has God set down in front of people? And is it because of something we have done? Is it because of something that God has done, that the things that have come to pass on the earth have indeed happened? But before we go to Genesis, I'd like to remind you of one little word which is used, not a great deal, but certainly used throughout the prophets. It's the word delicate. It's used of, particularly of women, but not so much women per se, more a sort of typical woman, if you will, that's as an example of the way things work. And we think of this creature as being somewhat spoiled. And this is the idea which is presented in Isaiah and Jeremiah, again here in Ezekiel. The idea of a spoilt creature. Someone who's had more than they really should have got it without any real effort, and thinks that it should go on forever, and then is suddenly surprised when it no longer, their lifestyle suddenly has to change dramatically. That's what happened with Tyre. They were rich the way people nowadays have got rich. They lost it very suddenly in a catastrophic series of events. In that day, the events were considered to be brought about directly by the action of God. Now, the sort of basis for everything which we read in our Bible starts in Genesis. And it's in Genesis that the nuts and bolts, the preambles, the fundamentals are set for us. And so when you open your book to the beginnings of the Bible, first chapter of Genesis, we read about three quarters of the way down the first chapter that God put plants on the earth. And every fruit tree, it says in the 28th verse, every fruit tree, 29th verse, I'm sorry, and I have given you every herb bearing seed, which is upon the face of the earth, every tree in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for meat. So in the very beginnings then, we're assured that there will be food provided from the earth by God. Now, when you turn over the page and you come to the 9th verse of the 2nd chapter, the Lord God made to grow every tree that is pleasant to sight, good for food, and the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So the Lord God made trees which would provide food for human beings. In the 17th verse, but the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat. So there's a little caution coming here. But we're told right at the very beginning then that God provided things on the earth which should sustain us. We're assured, however you read these chapters, these first two, three chapters of Genesis, that what God has said is that human beings are part of the earth, and the earth is adequate to maintain us in health and strength. Now, it's interesting when you get to the end of Ezekiel, that chapter that we had read, that there's another little addition to this idea of food being provided by the plants which are on the earth. And that is, Ezekiel says that the fruit of the tree is for meat, and the leaf is for medicine. So you see, the whole picture is brought together, that it doesn't just keep us alive on a daily basis, that there's what we need to look after us when things don't go quite so well here on the earth. The resources of the earth are adequate to maintain human beings in comfort, shall we say. Shall we put it that way? And that's what we're assured of in Genesis. When you turn over to the end of the eighth chapter, there's a little phrase right at the end. Now, this is at the end of the story of Noah. The earth is destroyed in a flood. People have died wholesale. only a very few people have survived the flood. And those that come out after they've survived this Holocaust are greeted with these words: "While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease." While the earth remaineth, from that time onward, seed time and harvest shall not cease. It's a continuation of what we read in the first and second chapters of Genesis. The earth will maintain you. When you get into the eighth chapter of Exodus, we're at a time now when the Israelites are in Egypt. They're sort of looking for a way out of this, and God sends Moses to them to deliver them. And with Moses come the words that they are to be taken to a land of milk and honey. That phrase is repeated twice in the third chapter of Exodus. It's repeated 11 more times in the remaining four books of Moses. It's repeated twice in Joshua when they go into the land that they've been promised. And retrospectively, it occurs twice in Jeremiah and twice in Ezekiel. So when you get to the days of Jeremiah and Ezekiel, God is looking back through time and saying, "I promised you this. I promised you a land of milk and honey." Well, the word which is translated milk, is its root meaning is fat. Nowadays, fat is a very unfashionable thing. We don't want fats in our diets. But if you lived outside, if you were on your feet all day, if you were working outside, fat is a very important contributing factor in your diet. Energy comes from that, burning that fat much more efficiently than burning carbohydrates or anything like that. And in addition to that, then the fat also provides much of the flavor. The word for honey, as far as one can tell, looking back at what people did in those days, does indeed mean honey. So what have you got? You're going into a land which is good for pasture. You're going into a land which will provide you with that milk. You're going into a land then which is fairly uniformly watered. You're going into a land which... And what do bees do? Nowadays, we're worried because we're losing bees in our environment. Nowadays, we're starting to get very environmentally conscious because of things that are going on in our society. We're losing other insects than the bees. And it's not just the herbicides and pests and insecticides anymore. These creatures are disappearing from our lifestyle. What's going to go with them? Pollination, the fruit that we pick from our trees that was spoken of there in that first chapter of Genesis, that 27th verse which we read. The flowers and many of the other things that we take so much for granted will not be there in as plentiful a form as our bees decline. So what God is really saying is that I'm sending you into an environment which will take care of you through time. I'm sending you into a place where you will be taken care of, and you can be assured of this. Well, there's the Old Testament. What happens when we turn over to the New Testament? And what's this got to do with economics? Whether we like it or not, the basic items of our economy are the things that keep us standing up. It's clean water and matters like that. It's an adequate food source. It's a way of keeping yourself warm. These are the basics. And those are the things that we talk about when we open our Bibles in Genesis. God assures us that those basics will be there for us. And that's the basis of our modern economy. When you turn over into the New Testament, I'd like to look quickly at a little section in the 6th chapter of Matthew. This is part of what's often referred to as the Sermon on the Mount. It comes with a couple of very interesting little illustrations. Jesus says, starting in the 25th verse, don't worry about what you're going to eat or what you're going to drink. Just think about what's around you. Think about the world around you. Think about the birds. They don't seem to worry. They just hop around. Where we live, the birds come and go, and in the last few days, they seem to have come back to us. I don't know where they go. They go hunting somewhere else for food and on and off. Then they come back and pick around in our plants for a while, and then they move off again. They seem to find all kinds of stuff in places that I wouldn't imagine to look. We have blue jays, and they pick up all the moss that's on our stones. Why do they do that? Because underneath the moss, there's all sorts of little insects. The jays just go, and all of the birds just go and come. We have woodpeckers around, and there are dead trees, and they find things in them. Woodpeckers, the jays, they're all provided for in the same way that God assured us in Genesis that human beings would be provided for. The earth will take care of the life which God has placed on it. That's the simple message. After the birds, the next illustration is some of the flowers. And if you have been to Israel in the springtime, you know that those, particularly the Galilean hills, they just suddenly explode in a burst of color. It's probable that what Jesus was talking about here was that dwarf iris, which grows quite plentifully along the shores of the Sea of Galilee. It comes in all sort of shades of sort of pale blues and almost white colors through to sort of pink colors, brilliant colors. And what Jesus is saying is we don't even think about that. But this form of life is sustained by the earth that it's in. God made that happen. And so the answer then goes on, well, don't worry for you, for yourself. If God will look after the birds, if God will look after the flowering plants, how much more will God look after you? Is the message which comes here in this 6th chapter of Matthew. And it closes with a rather interesting little phrase. Sufficient is the word. Sufficient unto the day. So maybe the problem is that when we start looking for something that's a little more than sufficiency, maybe that's when the troubles come. And maybe that's what's collapsed the economy. And maybe that's the thing that we're being warned against in the way the Bible is constructed. And maybe then we should be a little more careful, a little more prudent as someone said in the comments that were in the newspaper, a little more prudent in, for instance, the type of mortgages that people were applying for. But, and there's a big but here. And it's really interesting that what I did for you just a few minutes ago was avoid the context of this sixth chapter of Matthew. We jumped in and we said, well, as human beings, we are concerned about where our next meal's going to come from. Not excessively so, but we can always go to Thrifty's and find something. What are we going to have? We do think about these things. And God says, well, look around you. The life forms which are around you are taken care of. You should have enough faith to accept that if God will look after them, God will look after you. But what had been said just before that section started? What's the verse before the verse that I started in? That's a strange little verse. It's a most unusual little expression. No man can serve two masters. Where's the other master in this discussion? We're simply concerned about what we're going to eat, and God's assured us we're going to be able to get it. Where's the other master? No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one, love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. You cannot serve God and mammon. And that's the introduction to this little section which we just went through, talking about birds and flowers and things like that. That's the introduction. So Jesus seems to be saying to us that we have to be a little bit careful in where our values lie. Seek ye first the kingdom of God is the last but one verse in this chapter of Matthew. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things will be added unto you. You do that, you won't need to worry about all of these other odds and ends. You won't need to be concerned about that. But be very careful that you don't look to the other thing which can take our minds and occupy us so much, and if we will let it. The love of money, said Paul to Timothy, is the root of all evil, love of money. That's an interesting little word which is translated there, love of money. It's a single word in Greek, and it really means that you like silver. It's used twice more in Paul's writings, and on those other two occasions, it's translated covetousness. So you can see what's coming here is that if we go after all those things that we really think we really need, that's when we get into trouble. And that's what Jesus was striving for when he said you cannot serve God and mammon. Be careful where your values lie. Now, in addition to that, we need to go back to Genesis for a moment. And we need to start all over again. We're going to look at the 17th verse of the second chapter. And there it says, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it. For in the day that thou eatest thereof thou shalt surely die. And this comes right after the 16th verse which we looked at earlier, which says, of every tree in the garden thou mayest freely eat. So what we have, is the simple illustration that God provided everything we need to keep us alive, set this man and woman, Adam, in that garden, said, you can do anything, you can have anything you like, but there's one restriction. There is a little restriction. And when you turn over the page and come to the 16th verse, sixth verse. Genesis 3, verse 6. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof. And they both helped themselves to this tree then. And why did they do it? For the best of reasons. It was good food. Good quality merchandise. And they had this wonderful new experience of a brand new food source. They learned something from that. They learned a lot more than I'm indicating here at this time. But there was that sort of learning experience. So what does it mean? It means that the world offers us an adequate livelihood. It means that we're assured of this. The world will provide what we need. We don't have to worry. We will be looked after. We don't have to be concerned about the economy and what's going wrong here and there and everywhere, just as long as we accept that God has provided for our needs. But we have to accept that there are certain restrictions on the way we should behave. And maybe that's the point which was being made by so many commentators about the way our current economy is going, that people began to forget that there are restrictions. The books of Moses really set Israel off on a way of life which was based on an agricultural system. They had what we nowadays call an agrarian life form. They raised their crops, their taxes and so forth were a percentage of the crops which they prepared. The people who were part of the society that was established under Joshua in the land of Palestine, they were each guaranteed a portion of the land. They each inherited a section of land. And as we've seen from Genesis, God told them that the land will look after you. They were given that guarantee. And so they were presumably quite happy with that. But then after a number of years, the Assyrians came in and conquered them. And with the Assyrians came commerce in a big way. After that, the Babylonians brought a rather more advanced monetary system. And after them came the Persians. And the Persians inflicted their way of doing business on everybody throughout the Middle East, including the Israelites. And we have coins, for instance, Israeli coins, which have Persian effigies on them. So we know that the Persians really controlled the marketplace in those days. If you look at the sort of religious way this happened then, what happened within their religion, we find that when the Israelites came back to their land in the days of the Persians, they needed to change their way of life. They no longer were based on a land form which sort of guaranteed them a certain way of life. They're based on money now. And so they had to think things out. Did the law of Moses really fit when they came into this new land? Was it adequate with the new provisions that they had? Was it adequate for this new way of life which was based on money? And so the rabbis began to look at the number of commandments which were in Moses. They soon counted them all up and found that there were 613 commandments in Moses. They then started to look at this and said, why should we have 613? Well, 365 of them were for one for each day of the year. And then the remaining were 225, if I'm doing the maths right. And that was the number of bones in the human body. And so what you actually had then was a law which was applicable to every day of the year and which was applicable to every part of the human body. They took that concept and began to rewrite Moses a little bit. And so in the 24th chapter of Deuteronomy, we have two prescriptions. We have one near the beginning of the chapter, which talks about not taking the, you know, these little millstones which people had in their kitchens. You ground your corn with it and get your flour out and you can make bread. You can use your wheat. It was prohibited for anybody to take that millstone as a pledge against a mortgage. Now, why should that be important? Because if you did that, you took away their food source, just as readily as if you had taken the grain from them. There's a little prescription further down in that 24th chapter of Deuteronomy, which says that you would not take a widow's garment as a pledge for a loan. The rabbis took ideas like this and said that you should not take a widow's house in mortgage, that the widow was not to be made penniless under any circumstances. The interesting thing was that in the time of Christ, about equivalent to the time when these ideas were being formulated in rabbinical minds, the priests were taking widows' houses when mortgages ran afoul. The priests managed the banks. They took what couldn't be paid. And so the interesting thing is that we come face to face with what we have seen going on in our society now. People unable to pay their mortgages, and you jump on it. You don't give them a chance to rewrite or anything like that. You take it and use it for your own purposes. Moses had made it quite clear, and the rabbis saw that the concepts in Moses in Deuteronomy could be applied to a system which was based on money. You had to treat people and leave them with a livelihood. And that's one of the things which is going wrong in our society nowadays. Well, I have two more points to make. And the first one is that there is an idea which has been developing quite strongly in certain evangelical churches that if you get rich, it's because God has blessed you. God has given you this wealth. And this idea is based on verses like the 112th Psalm. 112th Psalm is very interesting in this regard. It starts out with a very general statement about believing in God. When you get to the third verse of that 112th Psalm, there's a very clear statement that if you do believe in God, you will gain wealth. And then when you get down to, I think it's the fifth verse in that Psalm, fifth or sixth verse, there's a little comment about social standing in society, about giving to the poor and so forth. In other words, we have somebody that has made this money and he's using it wisely. And then if you look in Proverbs, the third chapter and again the eighth chapter, there's a couple of little phrases which talk about getting wisdom. And if you get this wisdom, and that wisdom is seen as wisdom and belief in God, then if you've got that wisdom, riches and honor will come your way. And then we also have the comments which we have seen in the New Testament, in Matthew 6, that all of these things will be added unto you if you only have faith that God will deliver them. Well, is it real? Is it real? There's another way in which all of these phrases are used. There's another way in which the idea of wealth and the idea of riches is used in Proverbs, for instance, where those two verses that we mentioned have come from. And that is that physical wealth is not a good thing. It's an impediment. And what you really need to think about is a wealth of belief, a wealth of faith, and so forth. So certainly one should not say that if we do make money, then it's because God has blessed us. But we should also not think that if we don't make money, it's because God has cursed us. But above all, when we worry about what's going on in the financial systems and when we worry about what's going on in the world of money, we need to realize that if our faith is sound, that just as Jesus said in Matthew, we will be taken care of. Just as Genesis said, and Genesis starts the whole basis of the Bible, just as Genesis said, the earth is there to sustain human life on its face. I want to leave you with just one little idea from Revelation. Revelation's a fascinating little book. It's a book that an awful lot has been written about, and there are numerous interpretations about what it means. But when we get to the end of the book, and we're getting close to the end, and we start to see the promise of the marriage of the bridegroom and so forth, and we talk about a wedding, which is certainly referring to the time when Jesus shall return, and the things that we see in our world now, the comings and goings of all the monetary systems which are collapsing and the monetary systems which are trying to raise themselves. When we read in the 18th chapter of Revelation, words like these, and all the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn, the merchants are weeping and mourning. It's very descriptive of what's going on today. For no man buyeth their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold, silver, precious stones, and so forth. Fabrics are mentioned, woods and other commodities are mentioned in the list. Brass and iron, marble is there. Spices and so forth, foodstuffs are mentioned in the 13th verse. Fruits and all of these things are mentioned in the 14th verse. And several places here in this chapter, this 18th chapter of Revelation, we talk about merchandise, making money, buying and selling, gaining wealth. And that's a prelude to the idea of the Lamb of God returning to the earth, and things changing dramatically, things changing to be more God-centered, things changing to go back to a time when we will be much more aware of the fact that God has promised us that there is a life on this earth, that the earth can sustain and maintain us. Five chapters before that, in chapter 13, there's an interesting little notation. In this chapter 13, we're introduced to a beast. And the beast is mentioned in the same sort of words and phrases that are used in the 18th chapter. So by and large, we're talking, if not about exactly the same thing, about the same sort of thing. Third verse of this 13th chapter reads as follows. And I saw one of the heads of this beast, as it were, wounded to death. And his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And his deadly wound was healed. Now, when we're talking so much in Revelation, contrasting things that are so dear to people's hearts nowadays, buying and selling, making money, gaining wealth, and all of those things, as we saw there from the 18th chapter. And we look at one of those factors which are part of this whole system of making money, selling influence, and so forth, there in the 13th verse, 13th chapter, the third verse. And we find it suffers a mortal wound. Suggesting that we're looking here at the United States, but the United States really is the controlling factor in the world's economy at the moment. If it goes down, we're in real trouble. The whole of the Western world is in trouble, and much of the undeveloped world is in trouble. I don't know how big $1 trillion is. I hadn't even thought in terms of trillions until just these last few months. But the United States has been running a huge deficit for a long time. The people who have bought many of the bonds that have financed that deficit, a large number of them are in China, are getting into economic trouble. The United States is going to raise a whole pile more money. Where's it coming from? Somebody, our financial system is mortally wounded. I don't know. I'm not prepared to say for certain that that's what we're looking at here in this 13th chapter of Revelation. But it's a fascinating thought that the structures which people develop for themselves come to this point where they can no longer be maintained. And they struggle to keep themselves alive for a while. The Roman Empire did it. The British Empire is still sort of hanging on the way, you know, was it its heyday 100 years ago. The American Empire is now starting to shake a little bit. Human systems do that. They rise, they get cut down, they struggle for a while, and then one of these days, will be the return of the Lamb. So where are we? Well, surely it's quite clear that we shouldn't be overly worried about what's going on in the economy. Individuals may have problems, but collectively, we can manage. We can also manage if we're, as Genesis tells us, if we accept that there are certain restrictions which should be on human behavior. We can't go on as if the sky is the limit forever. We should realize that God expects us to behave in a responsible fashion. We should realize that God expects us to care for one another. That surely is the point in Jesus' comment about the widows and their houses. It's important then that we take a balanced and a patient view at what's going on. We realize that we've done it to ourselves as people, but that God will not desert us, and that one of these days, and it may be even sooner than we think, Jesus will return, and all of these problems will be behind us.